At least I was optimistic, although, as usual, Oroverberg did not share my optimism. I thought he would be free. He thought he might have more trouble, and probably for a long time. Monday, in the late morning hours, the lieutenant, his name was Treitel, T-R-E-I-T-E-L, from the CIC, appeared and picked us up. We attempted to use our skimpy English and find out why we were arrested and also what was going to happen to us. "You will see," was the only reply we got. Oroverberg and I had to climb in the back seat of the jeep, and the lieutenant and the driver took off. First, we went in the direction of the Mittelwerke, and we stopped at the gate of one of the labor and concentration camps. At this point, we both got somewhat scared. These camps were filled up with new, tired inmates. After some long minutes of waiting, Lieutenant Carter returned, and we took off again. Later in the day, we picked up some conversation between him and another CIC man, which made it quite obvious to us that he had made an attempt to put us in this concentration camp, which was run by former inmates, and he had planned to let us disappear in there. After a ride of about 25 to 30 minutes, we arrived in Bad Sachsa. The tent he mentioned there, which served as a local headquarters for the CIC. Here, he apparently talked to his boss to make further plans for us. After some long waiting, we again had to climb in the jeep and were taken to a large residence, which apparently was completely vacated and now occupied by GI. They led us down to the basement. Before we were locked up there, a sergeant noticed that I wore sunglasses. He took it off my nose and said, "Thanks, that's just what I need. You won't have any further use." Then they opened the coal cellar, pushed us in there, and locked the door behind us. That's the place where we had to stay overnight. We were sure of that. A few boxes, if I remember right, to sit on, but nothing to sleep on except the floor. After a while, I heard a voice outside. We asked to use the toilet, but the reply were only sneering remarks and laughter. So we just had to help ourselves there in the cold cellar. I remember it was very late in the afternoon. We looked through a small barred window and saw a young woman pushing a little baby cat, and she started to fraternize already with the GI. We were deeply disgusted about the lack of dignity. This woman flirted with the same soldiers who, we felt at least, treated us like criminals for no good reason. We were annoyed about this lack of national dignity and would have liked to get out of this place and slap her in her face. After the thoughts came in my mind to escape at the first opportunity, but then I told me, why take a chance? In a day or two, everything should be cleared up and we should be released. The next morning, we were again put on a jeep and taken to another city with the name Nordhausen. And there we were put to another jail, actually a high security prison, as we say in German. Each of us were put in a small cell without windows. Again, it contained a small wooden cot on which you could lay, and the usual toilet can. The doors were heavily secured, and again, the prison was mainly run by former inmates who were not political prisoners, but criminals who had served long sentences. Most of the people there were former, new inmates now, were mostly former Nazi officials, high-ranking SA and SS members, and probably some others like myself and Hooper. Once a day we were taken in the prison yard where we could walk around for about 30 minutes in a circle. Most of the SA and SS officers were still wearing their uniform, but without their fancy boots. They wore their breeches and with it, big wooden shoes. The inmates were now wearing the boots and let the Nazis have in turn their wooden shoes. And obviously enjoyed the ridiculous look of this new dress code they had introduced. He must have stayed in this full security chair for about 3 to 5 days, and then all the political prisoners and the two of us were moved by truck to a huge camp for German military prisoners near the city of Nuremberg. At least 30,000 to 40,000 prisoners were in this camp. In the middle of the camp, highly secured by barbed wire fences, was a small area which held an estimated 800 to 1,000 political prisoners. That's where we ended up. No shelters, no covers. Whatever you were wearing was all you had to protect you against the sun or rain or the cool winds of the night. You were fed once a day, and there were no eating utensils passed out. If you were lucky, you found an empty can or you borrowed a container from somebody who had stood early in the chow line. What you learned fast to trade and organize things. Within a day, almost everyone had found something where he could pick up his one day meal. The nights were too cold to get too much sleep. One had to go up frequently to walk around in order to get warm. Every day I had hoped that we would be released as soon as we would get a chance to talk to an officer and explain to them that we had really no political background which could possibly be of any interest to them. But we had become a number among thousands of political and military prisoners. So nobody came even close to us or talked to us. But I continued to be really optimistic. After a few days, the word came we would move again. I arrived with about 4 to 5 trucks. These were the retro army trucks, and this is hard to believe. They loaded about 70 people on one truck. You had to stand up and were squeezed together like these teams in a camp. Already before we left, a few older men who were among us fainted. We protested, but nobody listened and really cared about our voice. We finally took off, and in the first curve, one of the trucks broke down. The truck body, because of the excessive load, sheared off, and people fell off. Unfortunately, only a few were very lightly injured. We at this time were sure that they would reconsider and add at least two or a few more trucks in order to reduce the number of people loaded and to reduce the weight for the trucks. Not at all. After an hour of waiting, another truck came and the same number of people were put on the replacement vehicle, and in spite of our continuous protecting, we took off. Besides the driver, each truck had in front to see the military guard. When the driver reached the Autobahn, he drove as far as the vehicle could go. We were scared to death. From the early experience, we were certain that the trucks would fail again as soon as he would go with this kind of a speed in a curve or hit a hole in the pavement. At the time, we had to go off. At times, we had to go off the Autobahn and because of bump damage. This way, taking a detour, we came to my hometown, Weimar. When we crossed the town, we had a thunderstorm and heavy rain, and the driver got lost for a while and had to slow down quite a bit. And for a while, I thought, this is my opportunity. I could jump up and quickly disappear in a house and flee through the rear entrance before the guard could even find me. But then again, I rationalized, why taking a chance? Everything would be okay when we arrived at the new destination. So I didn't go through with it, and I have to say, to my letter request. We had one stop in the midst of the open country where it was easier for the guards to watch us, and finally after several hours of strenuous traveling, holding on to each other, we arrived at our new designation. Sign Rep. C.I.P. Kemp 95, Seton House. V-I-E-G-E-N-H-A-I-N. The end of the gate, and we have checked in. Before we were placed in the barracks, we had to empty our pockets and put everything on a table. We carried with us watches, rings, anything we wore. Fulbright had just picked up his monthly pay before he was arrested and carried this in his wallet. I think it was between 600 and 800 marks. And I had only a couple hundred marks, a watch and a ring. My wedding band I put in my mouth. That is the only thing I saved. In spite of promises he gave us to have everything returned, nobody got anything back because we had no receipt and therefore no proof of what we had left with us. The camp had been a former POW camp. There were about five times as many prisoners crowded in this indo bag it was designed for. You had to form small units. As far as I remember, there were about 20 people in the unit. One was appointed as leader. You had to keep strict discipline within the unit. I remember the number 28 because one loaf of flesh, and it was about 4 pounds of flesh, were divided among 28 people, each obtaining one slice of bread, which was besides a cup of soup, which was prepared from dehydrated vegetables and water, was the only additional nourishment we received. Badly enough, the soup was not even spiced with salt, since at this time salt was not available at all. Soon you had used up your reserves and got extremely hungry. There was grass around the back. We picked guava leaves and other small plants and roots to supplement our diet. There was really no way of making any contact if you were once inside the camp. There were fences of barbed wire, were placed around the camp, watchtowers, and bright lights made an escape impossible. Nobody could approach the fence from the outside either. God were opening immediately fire if friends or relatives of some of the prisoners tried to approach the camp and made an attempt to communicate with the inmates. The hunger became unbearable. Many of the older men got real sick. Occasionally a farmer came into the camp who was asked to remove some or clean some of the latrines, smuggled in a loaf of bread and threw it to the people when they felt they were not watched by the guard. It was a horrible thing to look at. The men were really fighting like animals to get a piece of it. Really, it wasn't worth it since it made hardly any sense to fight for it. It was really too little to make any difference. People changed their tacks on when they were hungry, and it was just a matter of frustration and trying to obtain some additional food. If you wanted to save some of your slice of bread for the next morning, you really had to carry it with you, and at night you had to sleep on it. Otherwise, you had to expect that it would be gone. Maybe a week had passed by, and our frustration had grown more and more because we just had no way of making any contact with the guards or the military personnel. An announcement was made that everyone who had worked on any secret project could say so. Otto Hoppeck and I didn't hesitate a minute to let them know about our retreat background. The next day, we were called to the CRC barracks outside the main tent, and we were asked to write down whatever we knew about the project and what role we both had played. This gave us also the first opportunity to get in contact with some CRC officers, and we finally asked the question, why in the hell are we in this prisoner camp? At first, a lieutenant, his name was Dr. Langer. He was a chemist in civilian life and also the huge air duct through which fresh air supplies could be pumped into the tunnel. At the same time, the duct would serve also as a huge trough to collect the seepage water from the ceiling. The entrance of the main production tunnel was protected by almost an 8 feet thick hydraulic operated concrete door, which would prevent any place damage inside of the tunnel into the event a large bomb would be dropped in front of the entrance. An emergency personnel door was provided in the event of damage of the main door's sliding mechanism, so they could always get out if the door was not in operation condition anymore. A telephone exchange with hotlines for direct access to Peenemünde, and government agencies at Perling, and a number of military.
In Friedland, then, in Nürnberg, he found a place close to the swimming pool that he thought we could build up our barracks, which we brought with us from Friedland, and our machinery. So the first thing we did, we got the holes in the ground for the foundation for our big compressors, and foundation to erect the prefabricated barrels again.
The same barrels
we stole somewhere close to in Friedland. In Friedland, then, in Nürnberg, he found a place close to the swimming pool that we thought we could build up our barracks, which we brought with us from Friedland, and our machinery. So the first thing we did, we got the holes in the ground for the foundation for our big compressors, and foundation to erect the prefabricated barrels again.
The same barrels
you stole somewhere close to Finland.